Good evening, everyone. It is Wednesday, October 9th, 2013. We get back to current Jewish questions. I think the last one we did before the summer and holiday break was on privacy. So we get to restart things up from scratch here. And what we're going to do in this time is, initially, I think this was the first class that I gave in this shul on an overview of Eruvin. It's something which, if you're the resident of the Lower East Side, you've probably complained about at length, very likely to me, which is understandable. I mean, I'm here and all that. But people, you know, ask a lot of things. It basically gets reduced to, well, we're just going to blame Rav Moshe for it. And, you know, we'll see if we can actually do his response inside. I'm not sure if it's too technical. But even before you get to that, you have to understand, at least, I think, the fundamentals of what is an Eruv. And it's one of, I think, the greatest ironies of Jewish law, where an Eruv that's supposed to be a unifying entity probably caused some of the biggest dissension within a Jewish community, particularly between Orthodox and non-Orthodox. If anyone remembers the book Jew versus Jew, had a chapter that kind of dealt with that. Tenafly, New Jersey had a big problem, and of course the Hamptons, which was actually mentioned on The Daily Show. I referred to a friend of mine, a non-Jewish friend, actually the person to whom we sold the Shul's Chametz, sends me an instant message asking, what's a Rishus HaRabim? Like, vocalized like that. I'm like, okay, that's a weird question to ask. So she was reading, I think it was the Yiddish Policeman's Ball, if that's the name of the book, or something like that. And I was like, oh, I need to explain what an Eruv is. So I just sent her a link to the Daily Show clip, The Thin Jew Line, which, if you haven't seen it, you really need to see it. And the truth is, you know, to an outsider, it really does seem like Wyatt Cenac's bacon hat, where you put on a hat that has strings around it, you can eat bacon in here, and everything is fine. And I understand that, because if you don't understand what these things do or how these things operate, it does seem to be incredibly silly. Should watch the video anyway because it's funny, objectively. But here, for the sheer part, we're going to try to explain what things are. This week is just going to be an introduction, and as we go on, I'll even, you know, say what we're going to be doing for the next 2 weeks in terms of dividing up in terms of components here. So first, does anyone know what the word Eruv means? All right, what's the root of Eruv? Three-letter root. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. So you say Eve, so there is a connection between them. So the real word of the real root of Eruv is a mixture, or a combination.
Like isn't that a mixture?
A tarovet. Oh. From kashrut.
Okay.
Right? One of the sections in of the laws of kashrut is tarovet, which is a mixture of food.
Yeah.
You know, ma'ariv or arvit isn't really supposed to be said at nightfall, it's supposed to be said in the evening when you've got a little bit of both. And because I can, I have to mention a really bad joke of my dad's. How do you say Arabian Nights in Hebrew? Ma'ariv Aravim. All right, very good. Polite laughs. Moving on. Exactly. So what an Eruv is supposed to do is it's supposed to create a mixture. So we're going to see develop throughout this class, functionally what it does is it takes a whole bunch of private residences and turns it into one big conglomerate. That is an Eruv in a nutshell. That's what the word means. You're trying to make one big unification of a bunch of smaller entities, which, again, makes the whole divisiveness part it really ironic and unfortunate, right? So let's start off with what we mean by a reshut. Take the first one. Jamie, this is Rambam. Oh, so I should phrase here as just a small preface. I really like quoting Gemaras more than anything else for a whole bunch of reasons. Here, I quote Rambam a little bit more because he does a really good summary of the Gemara. All right?
There are four domains regarding Shabbat. Rishut HaRabim, the public domain. A, road at least 16 amot wide, 28 feet. B, no roof. C, fewer than three walls. D, 600,000 people.
Notice, I put in an asterisk there, because that's not actually in the Rambam. Those following along, this is Rambam Hilchot Shabbat, chapter 14, very beginning. We'll talk about the 600,000 a little bit later, but I put an asterisk in that. You know what, I should probably put in parentheses too before I upload it, because it's not really Rambam. We'll deal with that in a bit, but at any rate, so the first is a public domain, and there are halachic criteria for what constitutes a halachic domain, or what constitutes a public domain in Jewish law. Next.
Rishut HaYachid, a private domain. area of 4x4 tefachim, surrounded by walls / divisions of 10 tefachim in height, which is 40 inches.
Right. And the truth is, when you hear these names of units of measurement like an amma or a tefach, they're kind of subject to debate. Right. I know if you can go to Brooklyn, you could actually find like an amma ruler, you know, that has the things break down, you know, with one side has it according to one opinion, the other side has it according to the other. But in halachic terminologies, it's a tefach, which is usually referred to as a, you know, hand breadth, however many inches that is.
Karmali does not meet criteria of Rishut HaRabim or Rishut HaYachid. A, does not have road cutting through it. B, does not have surrounding walls. And four, Makom Pator, area fewer than 4x4 tefachim, higher than 3 tefachim from the ground.
Okay. So we're going to need to know these a bit before we even get to Erevin. Very quickly, in terms of the ramifications for Kashrut, if you go from the public domain or private to public, you violate Shabbat, biblically, really bad. If you go from public to Carmelite, private to Carmelite, or backwards and forth, the area of a Carmelite is considered prohibited, but from rabbinic level. So it's a little bit easier. The Makom Patur, you know, think of it as like the top of a mailbox, like one of those things. It's almost like a safe zone. Mm-hmm. So there, it's called a Makom Patur because it's fine, right? So that's the main, you know, really, really quick overview of the laws here. With the 600,000 thing, that comes up as a huge, huge issue in terms of, you know, creating Erevin. We'll see, you know, eventually, you know, how you go about, you know, creating one of Rishut HaRabim. The reason why this comes up, I don't remember if it's in the other source sheet, but just quickly, it's not mentioned in the Talmud itself. It's mentioned in a later source that, according to Rabbi Howard Jachter in his book Gray Matter, quoted Rav Aaron Lichtenstein saying that this opinion is one of the most difficult ones in the Rishonim, largely because it's based off of an Agadah that could easily be interpreted in a whole lot of ways, but once you start relying on this, it really changes all the laws. So that 600,000 isn't really Maimonides. There are people who hold of it, and there's also a huge argument over what counts in this 600,000. But whatever. We can, for the moment, we don't need to know these details. I think we'll deal with that more next week. So right now, we've got these four domains. Josh, can you take laws of Erevin 1, 1, and 2, where it describes the basics?
Sure. There's a courtyard, which is shared by many neighbors, each with their own private residence, then according to biblical law, it is permitted to carry from each residence to the courtyard and to each other's residences, because they are all considered private domains. Similarly, for an alley, which has horizontal or vertical markers, or a city enclosed by a wall of 10 tefachim, and has doors which are closable at night, they are all private domains according to biblical law. However, rabbinic law prohibits neighbors from carrying in shared private spaces unless they are joined together before Shabbat. This applies to the courtyard, alleyway, or city. And this was the enactment of King Solomon and his court.
Okay. So, simply put, what does this Erev allow you to do? Even though they're technically private domains, what do you do with shared space? Right? Because if it's shared, it's not really private, because there are multiple owners, or at least multiple rights, which we'll deal with eventually. But it's also not public. Anyone here been in Chicago?
Very briefly.
Yes.
Like, have you seen some of the neighborhoods there? They have a lot of these alleys.
Yeah.
Right? In this classic sense where you've got, someone explained it to me once that it had to do with like snow removal type thing, where you got too snowed in, you need at least some way of like getting in and out or whatever. Mm. But whatever the reasons why, right, it's not uncommon to find, you know, I think it is more common, at least from what I've seen, you've got houses and houses, and you don't just have, you know, lawns in the back, you actually have a path, and that's shared space. Or another example may be you're in an apartment building, you know, what do you do with your hallway? Here, I'm actually going to take out the art scroll, because they have, in the Gemara, the very beginning, wonderful visual aid for this sort of thing that goes through. If anyone does here have an art scroll Gemara, check out for Erevin right before the introduction. It actually shows you a nice little grid here. I think it might be in volume 2 as well, so you can pass that around, of exactly how these things are laid out. I'll get you one, John. Hopefully it's in this one too. Otherwise, we'll just have to
we
share.
We could share, yeah.
For some reason, they only put it in Volume 1, which is a shame. But yeah, you can take a look at that, and that gives you a nice visual representation of what are these different types of Rashut. You see the private domains, you see the public domains, and you see how things are walled off and what that stuff matters. All right? Take the next one, John. Gemara and Erevin 21b.
Rav Yehuda stated in the name of Samuel, when Solomon ordained the laws of Eruv and the washing of the hands, a bat kol issued and proclaimed, "My son, if thy heart be wise, my heart will be glad, even mine." And furthermore, it is said in Scripture, "My son, be wise and make my heart glad, that I may answer him that taught me."
See, that's kind of interesting here. Like, Rambam, following the score, says, oh, the person who came up with the Eruv was King Solomon. Right? This was his idea. According to the Gemara, this is a really good idea. At least quoting Shmuel, to say that a bat kol came out and, you know, to cite a verse about, you know, just how wise someone is, you'd think is a pretty big ringing endorsement. Mm-hmm. Right? Rambam explains in Laws of Eruv in chapter 1, 4, and 5, why did King Solomon enact this? So that the nation would not err, saying that just as we may carry from our houses to the courtyards or streets, so too we may carry out into fields and deserts. And they will say, only the courtyards are private domains, and they will analogize as permitted to carry from public to private domains. Therefore, it was enacted that each private domain, which is divided into separate residences, would keep to itself and treat the shared space as a public domain. They combine to form an Eruv. All right, there's a little bit more to Maimonides, but this at least summarizes it. So here, Rambam even gives you the logic behind what King Solomon did. So right off the bat, right, we know kind of what an Eruv is. We know why, you know, it was constructed. Mm-hmm. And we also have a pretty big ringing endorsement. Mm-hmm. And that's important because you may find people who are somehow ideologically opposed to an Eruv. And they think there's something intrinsically wrong with it. Or they think that somehow... I mean, we're going to assume by Eruv, we're going to talk about an Eruv that everyone would agree is kosher, right? There are a whole bunch of arguments about what makes an Eruv kosher and what doesn't. But just even conceptually, people are bothered by the presence of an Eruv. Now, when King Solomon, again, considered to be a fairly smart fellow, comes up with it, gets the endorsement from a bat kol, at least as recorded in the Gemara, it does seem to indicate that the very innovation of an Eruv was viewed positively and is thus, according to Jewish tradition, a good thing. To stress this point, and the reason why I'm spending so much time on this is because I don't think it can be stressed enough. Jamie, take source number 5 here. This is Gemara and Eruv in 68a.
Rabbah, son of Rav Hanan, asked Abaye, how is it that in an alley in which two great men like you and Robert reside there should be neither Erev nor Shituv? What, the other replied, can we do? For the master, to collect the tenant's contribution, would not be becoming. I am busy with my studies and the other tenants do not care.
Yeah. It is an amazing thing for a whole bunch of reasons, including rabbinically. So you have Rabbah the son of Chana, mm-hmm. Astabaye. How come, he was neighbors with Rabbah? How come the two of you are living in the same place and you didn't put up an Eruv? The assumption was, you should. Not you're not. It's wait a second, how come you didn't do this? It seems almost, he seems almost incredulous. How could you not? Right? And that seems to be the premise of the question. And his answer is, first off, it's not, in the kavod, it's not it's not appropriate for the rabbi to go around asking for funds. If you're listening, this is a Gemara Eruv in 68a about certain things rabbis, are treated, to be, whatever. keep this particular Gemara in mind. And what does he say? Rabbah can't do it because, it's not really in his honor of his position to do it. I'm too busy because I've got other things to do. Keep this in mind. Rabbis occasionally try learning Torah, right? And everyone else doesn't care, right? Which we're going to deal with in week 3. So, you could extrapolate that to a whole lot of places. Why isn't there an Eruv? It's when there's so many great people. There are a whole bunch of logistic reasons there too. But what's important to recognize here is that the assumption is there is going to be an Eruv, or at least there ought to be an Eruv. I even had a case like that here, where there was a religious-looking guy who was carrying his talit to shul on Shabbat. And I ran into him in one of the in a co-op building a little later, and he said, yeah, you know, I was carrying because I couldn't imagine that so many Jews lived here and there wasn't an Eruv. That was his default. And you could say, well, that's a bad assumption. Truth is, based on this Gemara and Eruvin, it's not such a crazy assumption, or at least it wasn't a crazy assumption at one point in our history. All right? The next two sources go to show, I think, just to what extent Chazal sort of took things in order to make sure that Eruv, you know, that an Eruv was going to be feasible. This first, the Gemara and Eruv in 6b.
The halacha is always in agreement with Bet Hillel, but he who wishes to act in agreement with the ruling of Beit Shammai may do so, and he who wishes to act according to the view of Beit Hillel may do so. He, however, who adopts the more lenient ruling of Beit Shammai and the more lenient rulings of Beit Hillel is a wicked man, while of the man who adopts the restrictions of Beit Shammai and the restrictions of Beit Hillel, Scripture said, but the fool walketh in darkness. A man should rather act either in agreement with Beit Shammai, both in their lenient and their restrictive rulings, or in agreement with Beit Hillel in both lenient and restrictive rulings.
So you might remember we did this source a few times in our halachic process class. Really important for, you know, how halacha works. Rory Picker Nies, Maharad, who spoke here, actually used a term, which I'm going to give her credit for, because it was really funny, called a psak hop. Right, which is when you basically go to people to find the answers you want. Mm-hmm. Now, you can go to find the answers you want either to be strict or either to be lenient, mm-hmm. right? The assumption here is if you, I should say, it's not assumed, it's stated pretty much outright. If you follow the stricter opinions of Hillel and Shammai, you're an idiot. Mm-hmm. But if you follow the lenient ones, you are a rasha, you are considered evil. Rather, you know, pick a side and stick with it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a whole bunch that we can discuss about, you know, to what extent today, how does that work in terms of asking different questions and the like, but at least you see that the Gemara appreciates that you don't just look for stringencies and you don't just look for leniencies, okay? Because neither one is a valid approach to Jewish law. However, there are important exceptions to this. John, tell us what they are. This is Gemara Eruvin 46a.
Rav Yaakov ben Edi, Bar Edi, stated in the name of Rav Yeshua Bar Levi, halacha is in agreement with Rav Yochanan Bar Nuri. Said Rav Zera to Rav Yaakov Bar Edi, did you hear it explicitly or did you understand it by implication? I, the other replied, have heard it explicitly. What was the general statement? The one in which Rabbi Yeshua Bar Levi has laid down, halacha is in agreement with the authority that maintains the less restrictive ruling in respect of the laws of Eruv. What need then was there for the two statements? Rabbi Zera replied, both were required, for if we had been informed only that the halacha is in agreement with Rabbi Yochanan Bar Nuri, it might have been assumed that this applies in all cases, whether the halacha leads to a relaxation or to a restriction. Hence, we were informed that the halacha is in agreement with the authority that maintains a less restrictive ruling in respect of the laws of Eruv. Then let him state, the halacha is in agreement with the authority that maintains the less restrictive ruling in respect of Eruv. For what purpose was it necessary to state also that the halacha is in agreement with Rabbi Yochanan Bar Nuri? It was required because it might have been presumed that the statement applied only to an individual authority who differs from another individual authority, or to several authorities who differ from several authorities, but not to an individual authority who differed from several authorities.
So we saw, you know, a different excerpt of this particular passage in one of the halachic process questions too. You know, the operative statement here is you follow Divrei HaMekel be'Eruv. Anyone here know what the other area of halacha that we always go to the lenient side explicitly in this Gemara? Avelut, laws of mourning. Laws of mourning. Well, guess next time. It's not like it's not like you buzz in, we take points off. It's a good guess. Laws of mourning and laws of Eruv, you follow the lenient opinion. right? Even if, you know, it's a bit fascinating. For as strict as, remember, again, I put these two sources side by side for a reason. Going to that Gemara in the beginning of Erevin, you do that in other scenarios, you're considered wicked by following that approach. For Eruv and for Avelut, that's how the halacha is supposed to work. You follow the lenient opinions. Now, keep in mind, not every opinion, you know, is legitimate. Like, it's not that, oh, I just, like, there was a great example. Not sure if you guys remember this, but a few years ago, someone put up an art exhibition of an Eruv made out of light. I always say that was like shining lasers instead of string. No?
Sounds interesting.
Well, it's New York, this sort of thing. Yeah. If any place is going to happen, it's going to happen here.
Yeah.
So, like, someone gets up and says, oh, that works for an Eruv. Like, it's one thing you follow Divrei HaMekel, but that doesn't mean you just come up with anything that you see fit. Like, there still have to be processes, and there are still things in Eruv when the law comes up that are actually rejected. It's like, no, we actually don't follow that, right? So, in terms of the details here, again, it's something that you have to tread a little bit lightly with. The reason, again, why I'm bringing it up here is to show, for Chazal, there was an important need to have an Eruv, and seemed to, you know, set up special rules. I mean, for Avilut, we can understand, like, why you're going to want to be lenient there, because that is such an emotionally traumatic event. You know, we're going to give you a pass for a lot of things here. But for Eruv, you know, you're talking about potentially being Mechalel Shabbat. So there's a lot at stake there, as opposed to Avilut, you know, gets a little more complicated. But, you know, carrying on Shabbat's one of the Malachot, right? And yet you're going to intentionally try to be lenient in these matters, to, you know, make sure that there's an Eruv. Any questions so far?
In terms of measuring Hamot, do we really know?
Yeah, so we mentioned that a little bit earlier. We don't really know. You've got a lot of arguments in terms of exactly how much goes in each.
You have leniency there?
You know, that could be an interesting question. Would that count as a leniency over what counts as an Amar or what counts as a Tefach? That could be a legitimate place for it. Don't know. But that might be a good example for it. Because you're still saying tefach, but, you know, you don't really know what a tefach is. And the truth is, you know, how to put this? There are a lot of units of measurement used in Chazal, in the rabbinic literature, that are really inexact. And I actually had one teacher say, trying to give a fixed amount to it is itself a deviation from the rabbinic tradition. Because it's not supposed to be exact. There's supposed to be, like, estimations for stuff. Like, a tefach, people say, is a hand breadth. Now, my hand size is different than your hand size. Yeah. So what's considered a tefach? This give or take. Or a kizayit, right? What's an olive?
Right?
So trying to come up with an exact unit of measurement almost defeats the purpose of how we're supposed to do measurements. And it's a wonderful question, but, you know, someone is aside. But following that logic, they say, well, you know, this is a hand breadth. So one, two, three. So like this. All right. So those are three tefachim. That's it. There you go. So that is a possibility there. There are, you know, other reasons to put up Erevin. And I wanted to include here an unusual response and kind of my own response to this. This is from Rav Moshe Feinstein, Orach Chaim 528. It's dated March 8, 1981, and it was addressed to Mordechai Tendler. Okay? It's part of a long response. Sometimes in the response to literature, you've got like one question, one answer. Here, this is part 22. So this is a long one. Here's the question about part 22. Do we need to put in extra effort? No, I say what that N was, or at least in fixing an Eruv, to save people who are not keeping Shabbat in public. And Hebrew, it's even tzarich lishtadel b'tikun Eruvin kedei latzil mechalei Shabbat b'fai hesya mi'isur. This is an interesting question because, again, for people who are here for a while, know that Rav Moshe was relatively strict in Eruv. So think about it this way. Is it better to put up an Eruv that you disagree with, but you know someone else agrees with, right? Because that way the people who are carrying on Shabbat aren't according to those opinions, or better not to have one at all? And this is an argument that I've heard made here too, because, all right, so Rav Moshe doesn't like it, but wouldn't Rav Moshe want that people are Mechal Shabbat when they do carry, and there are quite a few people who do carry? Wouldn't Rav Moshe want them to be, you know, at least a little bit easier, you know, a little bit better off than not carrying at all, and are going to be Mechal Shabbat, desecrate Shabbat, according to everyone? He says no. Not just no, but this is one of the more harif, one of the more acerbic tones that I've heard him, or I shouldn't say heard, I didn't hear him, but that I've seen of his in Igrot Moshe, referring to Hamon Am, referring to the masses. We've seen he was really, really critical about Reform rabbis and conservative rabbis, but he usually gave the laity a pass. Or it was like, yeah, they're wrong, but whatever. But it's those rabbis that are leading people astray. This is how he writes. The fix of an Eruv for those who desecrate Shabbat in public is a matter of Tannaitic dispute, and it seems that the laws like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, in parentheses, that we really don't care, based on Gemara and Bava Kamma 69a. And also, most of those who do not keep Shabbat are deniers of the entire Torah, and everyone agrees there is no obligation, or even a commandment, it's a good deed, to build an Eruv on their behalf. And even regarding those who do not know better, their wickedness and their heresy comes to them from their wicked fathers. Therefore, they too are not fully considered sinning by accident, and they ignore those who are keeping the Torah, and those who are greater than their parents. Therefore, I am more convinced to say that there is no obligation to prevent them from sinning further. He also continues in this particular section that I didn't fully translate from the Hebrew, is that worse, you're going to make the people who don't carry sin. So let's say you put up an Eruv that does not meet the requirements of Rav Moshe Feinstein. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, well, first off, the fact that they're not observant, well, you know, no, that's not a reason to build it up. Mm-hmm. But look at all those observant people who aren't carrying. Once you put up an Eruv, like, yeah, they might be, you know, okay according to that person, but they're not okay to my standard. I still think that they're machal. Like, you're going to make the people who are carrying, he's basically saying, aren't worth it. And the ones who aren't carrying, you don't want to give them a false hope to say, hey, look, all of a sudden it's okay, because then you're actually, in his opinion, increasing a great deal of wrongdoing. George.
Is this from an early period in his life?
1981. So this is relatively late. One of the later responses. And it's interesting you mention that, because depending on what sort of conspiracy theorist you are, people have cast doubt on the authenticity of some of the later writings. Now, I am not an expert in Rav Moshe Feinstein by any stretch of the imagination. I'm not going to do a linguistic analysis on all his responses and even begin to address this claim. I'm just saying people have raised doubts about this sort of thing. I can say that this type of language seems unusual based on other things that I've read, but that to me is not even close to saying that it's fabricated. But it is an interesting question in terms of when. And it's also an interesting point that later on in life, his perception of the world could have changed from the 60s and 70s. Or at least 81, so maybe not too much from the 70s, but certainly from the early 70s. The world changed a lot from, you know, the 40s and 50s to 1981. So it could very well be he changed his mind. And people, incidentally, are allowed to change their mind. It's kind of amazing. I know this is a bit of a digression, but it's worth saying. If I were to tell someone that, you know, you reached your intellectual peak 40 years ago, never learned anything new, never changed your mind, never grew or developed, matured at all, you'd think that was a huge insult. And yet people are under the assumption when you're dealing with halachic literature that it's inconceivable someone might have changed their mind over a few decades. Like, people are people. My father's line is, if you're never willing to change your mind, you don't have a mind to change. And you would think that if you're actively engaged in the world, sort of dealing with the questions, not unlike what we saw this past Sunday, you're going to want to be somewhat adaptive, or at least to the reality around you. You know, so to what extent does this represent the view of Rav Moshe in the big cosmic sense, or the holistic sense, I should say? I don't know. All I can say is that this letter was dated 1981, March of 81.
Didn't he write it to the saying to the effect that if somebody came along with great learning and he decided to put one in, even though he wouldn't observe it?
Yeah, I told you that. We do that. That's class number three. That's class number three, but the difference there with that response, I know what you're referring to. I'll answer it very briefly.
It's like a change.
No. It's not a change in psak halacha. To explain, we're going to do a response a couple of weeks later about Rav Moshe acknowledging other people disagree. What he told the person was, don't protest putting one up. But if you asked him for his opinion, he was going to tell it to you. Like if you asked, hey, Rav Moshe, is this Erev kosher? He'd say, no, this Erev isn't kosher. Do other people agree? Sure. But there's a far cry from saying, I think such and such a thing is wrong, versus don't protest. What Rav Mordechai Tendler was asking was on a conceptual level, is the need, or would the hypothetical need to minimize the sinning of the non-observant Jews be enough, sufficient to put up an Erev that you yourself don't think is going to be kosher? And Rav Moshe says flat out no. Now, does that mean if you put one up that he would protest? That gets into a more political thing, which we do in 2 weeks. But it's not a contradiction. Because he asked him, or Tendler asked Rav Moshe, should this be a factor in being lenient? And Rav Moshe said, as a matter of psak, no. Or at least in 1981, he said that.
He and Rav Hankin were pretty close. And then Rav Moshe agreed to let Rav Hankin investigate whether it was possible to do so. Because they didn't
have it. But George, this isn't a psak from the Lower East Side. This is a psak to Rav Mordechai Tendler about setting halachic priorities. It's a nonspecific example. Got a question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess I'm having a little bit of trouble, like, kind of consolidating this opinion. So we just read before, okay, you go lenient when you're talking Erev.
Yes.
And then this opinion just seems to be very much not lenient. So I just don't understand
yes.
how that works.
I will explain that. I mean, truth is, this will probably go in its own section. The law follows a lenient opinion in Erev, assuming there's a dispute. As we mentioned, it depends what are those limits of who can say what and why.
Right.
Now, if you're convinced that someone else is wrong, a lenient opinion that's wrong is still wrong. You don't just say, oh, anything can go.
Right.
So, yes, Rav Moshe might have wanted things to be, you know, intrinsically might have wanted to put up an Eruv as much as anyone else. But if he thought that this particular way of doing it was halachically wrong, not just, like, completely illegitimate, then it's not for him a valid, what you might call a yeshal milismoch, a valid minority opinion on whom he could rely, because he thinks you're just wrong. He reads the Gemara differently, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah, elu ve'elu, like, I understand your opinion, but you're still wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is an important component right there, right? So that I think, is the difference, that even if you say you follow the Divrei HaMekel, you can almost intuitively understand there have to be limits to that. Otherwise, ein ledavar sof. Now, where you set up these limits and how you come up with those limits, matter of huge dispute.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Here's my own flip side with this that actually, you know, dovetails quite nicely with that. Mm-hmm. Rav Moshe here is incredibly, incredibly critical of people who are mechalel Shabbat. The problem that I have is that quite a few people are mechalel Shabbat, even without really realizing it, if you're going to be super, super technical. And here's something that, you know, would get me in trouble in many places, here included. First is a Mishnah in Shabbat 6:5. A woman may go out on Shabbat with ribbons made of hair, whether of her own hair or her companions, or an animal, and with frontlets, and with, or hair of her companions or of an animal. It's not, yeah, it means hair of an animal. That's why commas are important. And with frontlets or sarbitin that are fastened to her, she may go out with a hairnet, a kabul, and with a wig into the courtyard. Gemara in Shabbat 64b says, Rav said, wherever the sages forbade to go out, therefore into the street, one may not go out therewith into a courtyard, except a hairnet and wig. Now Rav, why do these differ? Said Ula, they are permitted lest she become repulsive to her husband. In plain English, what this means is, wearing a wig, according to strict Talmudic law, is a violation of Shabbat. It's considered an adornment, a tachshit. It's considered a type of jewelry or way that a wife makes herself look nicer to her husband by wearing a wig. So that's why there's a certain dispensation where she can wear it out in the courtyard. Otherwise, she wouldn't even be able to do that. So if I'm going to take Rav Moshe's view, or at least this opinion about Mechalei Shabbat always like being, you know, evil to the extent that he, you know, cites them as, well, then I'm going to have to start calling a whole lot of Jews evil. All right. Now, in terms of like why people wear wigs on Shabbat, do people have their own dispensations? No doubt that they do. Unfortunately, as we've discussed in the halachic process class, unless this came from a court, Jewish court, that is greater in number and greater than wisdom, halakhically obligated not to really give a damn, because no one really has the authority to overturn the laws of Chazal. Therefore, wigs on Shabbat, or at least without an Eruv, would be problematic. Now, if I were to get up here and, you know, go to, say, another synagogue where people very adamantly are proud that there isn't an Eruv and say, oh, yeah, by the way, though, according to technical Jewish law, all you women wearing shaitels aren't keeping Shabbat. Not going to go well. I can promise you that. And there are also a whole bunch of other things, you know, that you know, I speak about briefly, but it's one of those things where if you make too much of a deal, people like think you're crazy. Like wearing rings on Shabbat spoke, not a good thing either. So, you know, but certain things have become socially acceptable, but, you know, what are you going to do? So because of that, I'm not as, you know, taking, I also honestly never looked up what Rav Moshe says about wearing wigs on Shabbat. For all I know, he says it's okay. But again, Gemara seems to say no. Mm-hmm. But that aside, you know, there are, it's why on this particular point I would disagree with Rav Moshe Feinstein, not just as a matter of, this isn't really a matter of halacha, but a matter of psak. And the reason why there's an important distinction here, and I try making this distinction, halacha I call like the universal laws, which are, you know, what's permitted, what's prohibited. That those apply to Jews throughout time and history, regardless of place. Psak is more of what is the specific ruling that's appropriate to this particular community. And it might, you know, and there are a lot of different ways that you can do in the area of halacha. Two different rabbis who might agree completely with halacha can still come up to a different psak because of how they evaluate the situation. My own opinion would be, even though for my own reasons I don't use too many Eruvin, I think Eruvin today are important. Not just for the reasons that we saw earlier, that according to the Gemara, it's crucially important for people to do it. But from what I've seen, when people are Mechalel Shabbat, it's a huge compromise, particularly in the modern Orthodox world. I would rather have, as according to, in the language of another Gemara, mutav shiyu shogigim va'al yuhu mezidin. Better people sin in error than sin intentionally. I'd rather have someone use an Eruv that I personally don't think is kosher because they're still thinking they're keeping Shabbat. Once a person makes that leap and starts carrying and saying, yeah, I know and I don't care, you've already lost them a step further. That's less a pure halachic argument, more of a social psak, and that's not a matter of I know more than Rav Moshe. It's a matter that my experiences are very different than Rav Moshe. I've encountered a lot of different types of people. It's also a lot later than 1981. It could very well be, writing in the Lower East Side in 1981, Rav Moshe's psak might have been 100% correct based on what he saw, right? But someone in another community who has a different reality might see things a little bit differently. And I don't just mean in terms of economics, oh, we need to support the shul, blah, blah, blah. I'm talking about from a pure halachic level. Mutav shiyu shogigin v'alyu mezidin is also in the Talmud. And it is just my own opinion. I'd rather have people use an Eruv that I don't like than make that internal compromise of I'm not going to keep Shabbos. At least I'm not going to keep one aspect on Shabbos. Because to me, you know, once they start doing that, you have no idea when else they're going to stop. And I don't think it's out of, you know, pure wickedness. People want to lock their doors and get back into it on Shabbat. You know, that is a pretty big issue. Women who have kids, you know, one analogy I've heard is, you know, down here is that it's kind of like a prison. You know, there are reasons why, you know, people leave when they have kids because they don't want to be stuck in their apartment all day. So if that's what makes the difference for, you know, for you, well, should someone be carrying? Well, technically, no, right? But what are the costs of taking and relying on stricter opinions from a religious perspective? Again, there's if it's wrong, I still think something can be wrong. As a matter of psak, though, there is a great deal of compromising that comes up in psak halacha. Like, as I keep saying here, there's no single community where everyone does everything the rabbi says because the rabbi says so. Doesn't exist, right? So a rabbi has to pick his own battles and say, well, I can get away with this, but I can't get away with that. How do I pick and choose what I'm going to focus on? Sometimes it might be stricter in one area and be lenient in another area. That's where the art of psak comes in. But, you know, that takes a lot more time and experience to, like, really develop, but it's something that is justifiable, right? I think Rav Moshe has a defensible position. I think the other opinion is also going to be defensible. I mean, something else that, you know, is certainly to factor in that we didn't spend that much time on is being nikshal other people. Putting up an air that you think is bad, so what about all these people who never carried? Now they're going to start carrying. What about them? That's, I think, a really legitimate concern, too, from a halakhic perspective. What's the right answer? I think it's a judgment call. And when you come to a judgment call, it could be anything. The main point that I wanted to get across here is what exactly does an Eruv, what is an Eruv? What does it mean? What does it do? And at least to hammer home the point that even if, you know, people might disagree on the details of a specific Eruv, what seems indisputable from Chazal is that the concept of an Eruv is a good thing. Such that anyone who says Eruvin are bad, Eruvin are a way to cheat Shabbos, is not following the rabbinic tradition. That much I can say. Now, you can argue, it's like, well, I don't hold up this Eruv because of blah, blah, blah reason. Fine. But in general, anyone who says that the concept of an Eruv is somehow flawed or is itself somewhat a compromise that diminishes Shabbat does not know what they're talking about by way of Jewish law.
How far back is the notion of an Eruv going?
So as you saw earlier, according to the Gemara, it was created by King Solomon. Now, again, not being there, I don't know, but he's getting the credit for it.
And is there a stated reason for
it? Yeah, we did that. Rambam stated a reason for it. Rambam's rationale was people may come to carry from one domain to another domain once you can carry from one house to another house to a shared domain. So people could make a logical leap and start carrying it. That's Rambam's explanation. All right? So when you come time to putting up an Eruv, in terms of the details, this is what we're going to spend the next two weeks on. Next week, we're going to deal with the physical component. Those are the things I think people are much more familiar with, which is putting up the string, putting up the walls. We're going to talk about that next week. And the week after, we're going to talk about the conceptual component, which, while not discussed nearly as much as the string, well, Rabbi Gabay called it string theory. So I'll use that line again. People aren't as familiar with it, but it's probably just as, if not more, crucial, because without that social element, you have no Eruv. And the question that we're going to try to answer is, how do we take all of these independent individual private domains and turn them into one big shared private domain? So for part two on how to actually construct an Eruv, or at least the factors that are necessitated by that, come in next week.